This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places, in fact, to the very streets of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Past Beef Bowls and Auto Zones, the Sherman Oaks Galleria, we drive deeper and deeper into the San Fernando Valley.
Like, oh my God!
I will say that one thing I love about the San Fernando Valley is that the parking lots are really big. Down in the valley. There's ample parking, and I love that.
Michael Niemand has lived in the valley his entire life. He's not leaving anytime soon.
I also love that it's a giant grid. It's falsely accused of being boring. You know, I just love the feel of it. It just feels like home.
Oh, the places you'll go on Greater LA. You never know what you'll find. Today, it's a street that you probably never heard of.
I grew up on Rosendale Avenue, and if you just think about the name, there's quite a lot of potential there.
Rosendale Avenue in Arleta, in the northeastern corner of the San Fernando Valley. What can the name of this ordinary residential street tell us about the region that we all live in? What's in a name, especially a street name? It's a question Greater LA will be exploring in a series of stories over the next few weeks. And reporter Mike Schlitt gets us started.
So you've met my friend Michael Niemand. Let me tell you, he is obsessed with San Fernando Valley street names.
I wouldn't say obsessed, but when I look at a map and it's just filled with all of these tiny lines, in my head, I just know that every one of those lines is just filled with stories.
I don't really ever think about street names unless I'm lost.
Well, you're really missing out, I'm afraid.
Deirdre Mask wrote a whole book on street names and addresses.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we often think of street names as just being something quite practical, right? Market Street was where the market was. Church Street was where the church is.
You know, she says for centuries, street names were chosen specifically to help people not get lost. But eventually, people stopped needing street names to describe the places they were going.
And then the game begins to change. Naming becomes interconnected with what a place means. Just store memories and store ideas.
On the way to the Northeast Valley, you'll pass descriptive street names.
Laurel Canyon, the 70s.
Commemorative street names.
Mulholland, the Grand Poobah.
Aspirational street names.
Victory Boulevard. I've always struggled to find anything victorious about it.
And street names that are just straight up lies.
I went to Beachy Avenue Elementary School. Beachy, like sort of like the beach. Like if there were a beach in Arleta. Let's go surfing now,
everybody's learning how. People want to live on a street that is a desirable name. And marketers know that. There are streets that are marketed very much to sound like affluent places, to correspond street names with house value.
If you want to find the real story behind the street names, sometimes you just got to go there. Today, let's go to Rosendale Avenue.
So I'm on Rosendale Avenue. I spent my whole life on the street. Let me just pull over here for a second. These people are probably wondering why I'm stopped in front of their house.
Rosendale Avenue first appeared on the map in 1952 in one of nine new tracks built that year between Canterbury and Beachy. At the time, it was part of Pacoima. Now it's Arleta. Talk about a bunch of great names. On Michael's block, there are 35 houses and 38 sycamore trees.
In our little track, I always felt that we had the best street.
So what do we make of the name Rosendale? Sounds kind of fancy, right? So maybe you'd expect fancy people would want to live there?
Oh, I'm packing my grill, and I'm leaving today.
In 1952, my wife, Jeannie, and I decided to come out to California.
So that's your dad, right?
That's my dad, 92 years old. He's quite a guy.
And everybody calls him by a nickname.
Well, everyone calls him Big Murray, yeah.
And how tall is he?
About 5'8".
And make the San Fernando Valley my home.
There was a tool and die maker. I was living with my mother, so you know I was desperate. I packed my toolbox up and I brought it with me, and I ended up going to work for Hughes Aircraft.
When Big Murray arrived, aerospace jobs in Southern California took off like a rocket for engineers and blue-collar guys.
the dream of aerospace suburbs was always of an upward trajectory.
DJ Waldy wrote a book called Holy Land, a suburban memoir. He lives in the same Lakewood home his parents bought in 1946.
Everyone's expectations that next year's paycheck will be bigger than this year's paycheck. You can imagine what that might mean to people who had only a high school education.
We went out there and we looked at a number of houses out in the valley. And then we went to look at this one in Pacoima. We liked this one. But who knew from Pacoima?
Who knew from Pacoima? Well, Black and Latino people knew. In 1952, Pacoima was one of the only places in the valley they could buy a home. On Roslindale, when Big Murray arrived, there were already Jewish, Japanese, and Latino families living there.
Those young men and young women, many of them former GIs, didn't want more. They wanted just enough. All the developer had to do was put an ad in the LA Times, and there'd be a line of people out in front with a firm conviction that they were going to buy that house.
The house Big Murray had his eye on was 1,200 square feet, 3 bedrooms, 1 3/4 baths, asphalt driveway, cheaper than concrete, attached garage, cheaper than a detached garage, and a tiny backyard right next to a bunch of giant transmission towers. Now that was a real cost saver.
It was a $12,000 house, no money down, $12,240. I remember that because I was a veteran. They gave me back the $240.
Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream.
I don't know that somebody would point their finger out to the Northeastern Valley on Roslindale Street and say, this is where I want to be. But I think if they ended up there, I think they'd probably be pretty happy.
Michael stops in front of a little beige house, right next to two of those transmission towers, just a few doors down from where he grew up. And this house, I don't know, it's just so ordinary, nondescript. It's the kind of house you could walk by a million times and you'd never even notice it. Which might be the reason.
That was the house that they used in Back to the Future.
Oh, it was on your street?
Yeah. It was on our street. Roslindale Avenue is the street that the DeLorean drives down, takes off. So,
oh, God,
I thought I told you that.
When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious.
So, yeah, turns out that's the Marty McFly house from the 1985 movie Back to the Future. Michael J. Fox's character lived in that house with his cowardly dad.
You're right.
And his alcoholic mom.
We're going to have to eat this cake by ourselves.
This McFly family, they are all just incredibly unfulfilled people.
I'm sorry.
But it all works out in the end, thanks to a little time travel intervention. In the very last shot of the movie, the DeLorean hovers up in the air, then glides off through a lush canopy of sycamore trees. Roslindale sycamore trees. The music swells, the audience swoons, the box office soars.
Susie, is that you?
Mike Neiman.
Hey, Susie.
Hi, Mrs. Moskowitz.
When we meet some neighbors, Michael tells them we're doing a radio story on LA streets. And all anyone wants to talk about...
The Back to the Future house is on this street.
Is it the Back to the Future house? Or like, no, it's 3 houses down.
But eventually, we do start talking about other things.
I love the trees on the street.
I never had a key to my house. My house was always open.
Everybody seems to know everybody.
So we have Filipino, a lot of Latino, a lot of, there's Armenian, so it's pretty mixed up.
When my dad had his stroke, the neighboring kids did the lawn and kept the house up.
Where I lived before, it was a mobile home, so it was just obviously an improvement.
Now, I gotta say, unlike the McFly family, all of these people seem pretty fulfilled. And I don't think it's just because Back to the Future was filmed here.
I think everyone on the street knew what hard times were. Because of those hard times, they knew what it was like to also know when something was good.
I was born in Poland in 1935 in the town where about 6,000 Jewish families living and maybe 150 people survived. We came here with absolutely nothing. Well, it was an entirely a different way of living.
What kind of
we
way of
didn't
life?
Even know that this kind of life existed. I raised my family, and that was the best part of my life.
When you confront a street name, you confront a story. And the story of Roslindale, this tiny street with a fancy name and a lot of down-to-earth people, it's simple. A safe, quiet, ordinary place can be sacred to the people who live there. And also, because it's a Los Angeles street, they shot a movie here. And now people come from all over the world.
Кристина, у меня интервью берут, ты понимаешь, это непростое место.
Just to catch a glimpse of a nondescript house on an ordinary street.
So that's the house.
In the northeast corner of the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out at first which house was it. Now I see it's this one.
You recognize it?
Yes. I'm a big fan of the movie.
On Roslindale Avenue, I'm Mike Schlitt for KCRW.
Well, there's Huey Lewis. We've got more news coming up. Next week, some call it the spine of L.A. We'll explore the history behind the name of Wilshire Boulevard. That's next week on KCRW's Greater L.A.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Cargo ships coming from Asia into L.A. area ports were backed up at the peak of the pandemic. But now it's smooth sailing, according to the Port of L.A. Executive Director Gene Soroka. He spoke about the current situation earlier.
Once again, we're breaking records with this extraordinary level of business activity. The Port of Los Angeles processed more than 957,000 container units in March. That's a big number in a peak season month like September or October, but we've never seen volume like this in the first half of a calendar year.
Now, that should be good news to boba drinkers and store owners. The boba, those globs of tapioca that go into sweet drinks, are unfortunately on the brink of running out across America right now, and that has created a big ball of concern for boba drinkers and store owners. Here are Andrew Chow and Bin Chen, owners of the chain Boba Guys, which has stores here in Greater L.A. and the Bay Area and in New York City.
We're seeing impact from this entire shortage. We're trying to figure out where you can get tapioca from. We're trying to import it through different means without ships. But it does mean that boba is going to be out, and that's going to be weird for a lot of us who run boba shops.
Yeah, boba shops without boba. Here to talk about the current situation is Janelle Bitker, who writes about food for the San Francisco Chronicle. Hey, Janelle.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How dire is this?
If you're a boba fan, it sounds pretty dire. Major boba suppliers in California say they are almost out of boba and they have no idea when they're going to get more, which means many stores are on their last week, most likely.
I mean, there are no local makers of boba. It's all imported from overseas?
99% of the boba we drink in the U.S. is imported from Taiwan. There is only one factory in the U.S., and that's in Hayward, called U.S. Boba Company. But they're having a hard time, too, because they can't get tapioca starch, which is the key ingredient for the tapioca balls. Those are also stuck on the water outside Oakland. There are some small boba shops that make their own boba just for themselves, and they might be in better shape.
Hayward is in the Bay Area, right? I know that. I would think a lot of boba shops were probably closed during the pandemic. Did they not have a buildup of boba inventory? Does boba spoil? I mean, how does that work?
Boba shelf life is pretty good. From what I've been hearing from wholesalers is, yes, a lot of boba shops were closed for months during the pandemic, especially in busy places like San Francisco and LA. But the boba shortage has been an issue for a few weeks now, so they've been depleting their supply.
I know that this boba craze has really taken off in the past, well, certainly the past few years, but even the past 10 or 20 years. Do you have any sense of how big boba's gotten?
Yeah, I remember when boba shops first started opening in the Bay Area 20 years ago, and now it seems like there's a new boba shop every few weeks in some neighborhoods. In the U.S., it's estimated to be a $2 billion industry and growing.
Wow. But it's not just a question of dollars, right? Boba is a part of the culture, at least even here in Southern California. I mean, are people worried that a shock to supply like this could cause permanent damage?
I think given a lot of people go to boba shops for the boba, they want that chewy sensation in their drink, it could really hurt a lot of boba shops, especially small independent ones that are already struggling because of the pandemic.
But Janelle, alas, do you have good news? Do we know how long this shortage is going to last and trying to, you know, I mean, sort of, dare I say, ungum the system?
No one knows for sure, but some suppliers I talked to felt optimistic that maybe they could catch up in the next couple of weeks. Others saw it could be as long as 4 months before we reliably have boba again.
Ooh. And what about you? You're a boba drinker? I mean, are you upset about this? How are you feeling about all of this?
I don't depend on boba for my day to day, but I do love it as the occasional treat. And as soon as I reported this story yesterday, I went out for some boba.
And you found it?
I found it, yes. There are some stores that told me they have a few weeks supply in their own pantries just because they actually foresaw a shortage and stocked up early. And others, you know, still have some this week, but might be in trouble next week.
Do you see with this shortage, Janelle? Oh, I hate to say this, but like boba gouging?
Oh, that's a great question. It's possible the places that still have boba will see so much demand that they decide to hike up their prices.
Right. I mean, as we see in situations like this with a lot of things, right? I mean, toilet paper. Remember toilet paper at the beginning of the pandemic? I mean, that was crazy.
Exactly. And some suppliers told me that because shipping costs are just more now and they're spending more to get the boba, they might have no choice but in the future to raise the price, which could pass on to the stores, which could pass on to customers. The going rate right now for boba is 50 cents. But would you pay a dollar for boba?
Well, that's the question going forward. Janelle, I want to thank you for coming on and talking about it. Janelle Bitker, who writes about food for the San Francisco Chronicle. Janelle, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Well, if you can't get your boba fix, maybe some ice cream will make you feel better. After all, it's a staple for any breakup or a bad day, along with a cozy blanket, some tissues, a friendly ear. One woman in Koreatown launched a business that brings all those elements together. She's serving up ice cream with a side of mental health support, all with a scoop of help.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, how do you Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Sue Mancini owns Sad Girl Creamery, an ice cream pop-up that she runs out of her apartment. And through her sweet treats, she broaches some pretty sensitive topics surrounding mental health and self-care. things some folks can become frozen to talk about. But Sue is here to talk about it with us. Anyway, hey there.
Hey.
What made you want to spread mental health awareness through ice cream?
Well, first of all, I always knew I wanted to start an ice cream company. I've been actually working on this project for like 7 years.
Wow.
And I figured that I also wanted to create something that was in the service of helping people. So I don't know, the idea kind of came up, especially last year during the height of the pandemic when everyone was stuck at home. And I figured sharing my own personal experiences with mental health could hopefully make people relate and feel a little alleviated with the sad feelings they're having at home. And ice cream is definitely something that cheers people up. So,
you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder when you were 26. Was it hard for you and your family to talk about?
Yeah, totally. It was hard for me to even like think about, it was definitely hard to like accept it. But at the same time, it did bring a lot of clarity because I had been dealing with ups and downs since I was 14 and all of it was very confusing. For a while I thought that it was just like teenage angst and I was just like, it'll just go away with time, but it definitely continued as I got older. So it was very hard being told that and then trying to then navigate what I needed to do to better myself and to make a lot of these hard times lessen.
You're Latina, you grew up in a Latin American family. Do you think it's harder in a Latinx family to be open about mental health?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's not very common that, especially in immigrant families, that we talk about things like mental health. And I think that usually just comes from like a hardworking mentality because, you know, your family moves here because of whatever reason. And so definitely you're put into this survival mode. So if you're like talking about being sad, it's kind of like combating those two ideas of like, well, you can overcome that sadness on your own, can't you?
And sometimes people need some help.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what I'm learning right now as I get older. And, you know, it's still a process as I'm going. And I definitely use the page as like, also a personal diary.
You have this super fun, colorful Instagram account where people can find out where your pop-ups are and how to order pints of your ice cream, but it's also where you talk about that mental health as well. How do you weave those things together, especially in a pandemic?
Actually, a lot of it happens through my DMs on Instagram. So I'll post about a certain subject, and I guess people will resonate with something that I'm talking about, whether it's like self-harm or, I don't know, like binge watching TV. They'll usually like DM me and be like, oh, like, thank you so much for posting about this. I also deal with et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know. And then I just, yeah, definitely have like a one-on-one conversation with my customers on there.
What do you see for your business going forward now that the pandemic is starting to ease up a little bit? I mean, you know, a lot of folks go to a bartender, you know, the bartender is sort of their counselor. Where does your business go forward? Do you keep it up this way? Do you foresee, you know, expanding in some way?
Yeah, I for sure want to expand. The end goal would definitely be to try to have a brick and mortar and serve ice cream there and hopefully maybe start having ice cream socials where I can invite possibly other nonprofits or professionals who deal with mental health, maybe come like talk to people while we have an ice cream social, and want to try to make it as community-based as possible and offer those kind of events.
I want to thank you for your time. It's fascinating and it sounds delicious. Sue Mancini, who owns Sad Girl Creamery in Koreatown. You can find her, by the way, on Instagram at Sad Girl Creamery. Sue, thank you for joining us, and we appreciate all your help for the community.
Thank you so much.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, the sheer number of kids crossing the border alone is forcing the federal government to put them in large spaces like the Long Beach Convention Center or Pomona Fairplex, getting some criticism from people on all sides of the issue. An update on that story tomorrow. Also tomorrow, another segment in our I'm Vaccinated series, where we ask what you're doing now that you have all your shots. When you tell us online at KCRW.com, we put you in our episode and talk about life getting perhaps, back to normal. And by the way, you can find any episode of Greater LA online and subscribe to the podcast, too, at KCRW.com/Greater LA. Thank you for your time and attention this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great night.